Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello and welcome to Nature Now for the third week of December 2018. I'm your host, Paul Rubin. Today, I will be talking with Carol McCreary, Program Manager and Co-Founder of Flush, or Public Hygiene Lets Us Stay Human. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Paul. Really nice to be here with you today.
Yeah, we're happy to have you. So we're going to start with observations and news today with Carol's help. On Saturday, December 15th, I was part of the Maristone Island Christmas Bird Count. It was a very windy day, but we were still able to find some birds around Fort Flagler and the south side of Maristone. A group member was nice enough to let us bird from his house on the bluff. We spotted buffaloheads, surf scoters, Pacific loons, common loons, horned grebes, and western grebes, among many others.
World Toilet Day. World Toilet Day is celebrated every November in support of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal number 6. Goal number 6 is to ensure the availability and sustainable management of sanitation and water for everyone in the world by 2030. Currently, 4.5 billion people live without safely managed systems. With half of the world's people now living in urban areas, safely managed sanitation is at the heart of water stewardship. The theme of this year's World Toilet Day is When Nature Calls. The UN notes that when human feces is not captured or contained, we, quote, turn our environment into an open sewer, unquote. This year's focus is on building toilets and sanitation systems that work in harmony with the world's ecosystems. World Toilet Day 2018 is about nature-based solutions to our sanitation needs.
The 2015 Waters of the United States, or WOTUS, ruling was revised on December 11, 2018 by the EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The 2015 ruling may have greatly expanded the federal government's control over land use decisions, which the proposal intends to reduce. Interstate waters will no longer be an independent category of jurisdictional water. Ephemeral or rain-dependent ditches, rivers, or streams will no longer be considered jurisdictional, and fewer wetlands, lakes, and ponds will be considered jurisdictional because of the proposal's requirement of a direct hydrological connection. Traditional navigable waters will continue to exist under federal jurisdiction without any changes. Perhaps the biggest exclusion is the significant nexus test, which was required for determining if a wetland or water had a nexus to local navigable water and if an impact would be significant. Although somewhat confusing and usually requiring additional permitting time, this information was fact-based and evaluated the functions and values of wetlands. This ruling affects Washington, 21 other states, the District of Columbia, and U.S. territories who are all under the 2015 Clean Water Rule.
Bill Gates recently took his popular Reinvent the Toilet challenge to China. This is a continuation of a series that's been held for nearly a decade. The Seattle-based Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is leading the advancement of off-grid toilet technologies and sanitation systems. Gates symbolically held a jar containing human feces in front of a crowded Beijing audience to stress the potential catastrophe of untreated human excrement. Gates added, "This amount here could contain as many as 200 trillion rotavirus cells, 20 billion Shigella bacteria, and 100,000 parasitic worm eggs." Quote, "In places without safe sanitation, there is much more than one jar's worth in the environment," Gates said. "These and other pathogens cause diseases like diarrhea, cholera, and typhoid that kill nearly 500,000 children under the age of 5 every year." One North Seattle company was granted a commercialization license from the Gates Foundation for their innovative processes of turning solid waste into electricity and clean drinking water using a small-scale self-powered treatment plant.
Washington Governor Jay Inslee proposed relatively groundbreaking legislation to reduce carbon emissions last week. The state will eventually require state utilities to completely abandon fossil fuels by 2045. The plan also calls for an adoption of a clean fuel standard, which is similar to Oregon, California, and British Columbia. Effects of the action aim to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to pre-1990 levels by 2035.
On December 7th, the Discovery Bay Raptor Rehabilitation Center held a wild bird event at the Chandlery of the Maritime Center. Cynthia Daly and her volunteers brought over 5 different raptors. The Chandlery was overflowing with people of all ages. The presentation included natural history, bird issues in our community, and the stories of the hawks, owls, and falcons that were showcased.
Great. So thanks, Carol, for helping us with news and events. I think we're going to go on to our mystery sound. Let's play it now. A hint, these birds are residents throughout our area and can be found in fields, meadows, and lawns. Males sing a liquid-sounding series of low gurgling notes followed by the thin, sliding whistles, lasting slightly longer than 1 second. Song learning in this species has been an interesting scientific puzzle, since the birds aren't raised by members of their own species. And now on to our interview portion of today. Carol and I will be speaking about enhancing water stewardship with waterless toilets. Carol, can you tell us what the mission of Flush is?
Well, at Flush, we believe that toilet availability is a human right, and that well-designed sanitation systems restore health to our cities, our waters, and our soils. Our mission reads as follows. Through education and advocacy, Flush helps local governments and citizen groups to provide equitable public restroom availability and to prepare for a pipe-breaking seismic event with appropriate ecological toilet systems. So Flush works in 2 areas. First of all, in the area of urban planning and livability, because public toilets need to be part of our streetscapes. Second, we work in emergency preparedness because a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake is going to break water and sewer pipes. Our toilets won't work, treatment facilities will go down, and water will be scarce. Now, drinking water is a matter of life or death within the first week of such a disaster. So professional first responders will be busy with that and all the rest. As for managing sanitation, households and neighborhoods can do that, at least in the first month. And the responsibility needs to be given to them to do that, as fortunately it is in Jefferson County.
I think a lot of people think of this potential earthquake and tsunami, and they think of the immediate, survive and get to high ground. But what a lot of people forget is what happens the first week, the first 2 weeks, or a month and longer. You know, what do people do when a destroyed public sewage system is something that could totally, you know, easily happen? And that gives us not many options. So yeah, it's cool to know that you, with Flush, you're looking into these things. How can we prepare for natural disasters? And I know there's Portland, there was an example of them taking the initiative and thinking about this.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about our work there. But first, you know, we had all the things that happened in 2017 and 2018. Puerto Rico having to wait a year to get their systems back. The low-lying areas of Houston and Florida being
decimated.
Ravaged.
Yeah.
And the wastewater, the sophisticated, expensive wastewater treatment facilities going out. We don't have a lot of documentation of that, but I gather it was very, very serious and extremely expensive to repair. But we work at a very, very simple level. We don't feel that disaster sanitation is rocket science and that we can protect ourselves from disease by doing a few simple things. But when we first started, we had no idea what to do. We were founded over a decade ago as part of the City of Portland Neighborhood Governance System, one of those nonprofits that work together at the local level. The risk and hazard assessments of both Oregon and Washington State say that it'll take, if it's a 9.0 quake, it'll take up to 3 years to bring the systems back to 80% of their original workability.
Yeah.
So we started our research, and the interesting thing was we found almost nothing. The guidelines offered by FEMA and then picked up by the states were entirely inadequate because they all assumed, and still do assume, that there are safe disposal options, which there won't be when the roads go down and the trucks can't move
transportation.
And everything else. The Washington Preparedness Guide still says, here's what you should do. Just line your toilet bowl with a garbage bag and let me quote what you're supposed to do with it. When finished, add a small amount of deodorant or disinfectant, securely tie the bag, and dispose of it in a large trash can with a tight-fitting lid. Well, that to us sounded like a real recipe for an epidemic.
Sounds like, it sounds like ignoring the actual issue and trying to come up with anything.
Right? Well, emergency sanitation, when the main on your street goes down, that's okay, assuming that there are disposal options elsewhere in the city.
Yeah.
But it won't work for the Cascadia quake. We looked around and looked around, and then in mid-2011, the New Zealand Permaculture Guild responded to the devastation of the Christchurch quake, and they threw up a website telling the people of the Wellington area of New Zealand how to build twin pee and poo buckets in their homes. And those people there have indeed done that. What we did was we immediately adapted this idea of one bucket for pee and one bucket for poop to the vertical neighborhoods of downtown Portland. And we showed people how to make and use nested 5-gallon buckets, how to put them into a kit, how to put the supplies necessary to use them into the nested kit. And we went around to all our meetings with our twin buckets, as we still do in all the places we're working.
So I feel there's an elephant in the room sometimes. And I know that in the past conversations we've had about this subject, people overhear us talking and they, what are they talking about over there? You know, because we say poop, and I just want to clear the air. Poop. Everyone's doing it, and it's totally okay to talk about. We can solve new problems. We can look at problems that exist and see how we can overcome them. And I just always think it's funny that a lot of people feel uncomfortable talking about this. And I also know that in the past, I've asked people in a room, because I've used a composting toilet, and we'll get into that. How many people in this room have used a composting toilet? And surprisingly, at least a quarter of the people, sometimes more, have used a composting toilet, which is a very basic system of keeping waste in a closed cycle where you're not just throwing it down and then getting into a bigger water body like the Puget Sound, which I don't know if we'll touch that so much.
You're right. Normal, ordinary households and people can understand closed loops through these technologies, whereas though the rest of our systems are fairly hidden, and septic systems are also quite complicated.
And I know a lot of people want to talk about this because it's not being talked about. And wherever I go, you know, we've talked about this too, but I if this subject comes up, there's always someone that wants to get my card, or who are you? How do I have a friend, and I think it's them, but I have a friend and I have another friend, and they're all interested. We want more information. We want to know how we can do this. Hopefully we can offer the listeners a little bit of how they can do this and what your organization does to give information.
Well, as I say, we do work under the umbrella of disaster sanitation. The whole field of public health has to do with managing sanitation, because that permits water stewardship and clean water availability. We're pretty careful about that, but we definitely want communities to plan and to not only leave it to be figured out later, but to actually explore neighborhood by neighborhood and area by area the ecosystems that they have and the appropriateness of different kinds of composting and different kinds of treatment.
Yeah, because each climate has a different, slightly different system for what works best.
And the literature is there. Our group does knowledge management in this area, but we work very much with international organizations just to share the knowledge while we don't offer seminars in practice.
Yeah. So can you tell us about the public toilet advocacy toolkit that Flush offers?
Well, you know, that's we start right out with why is it so hard to talk about these things? How do you get the conversation started? And we give people ideas of how to frame it for different audiences. One of our most favorite audiences are middle schoolers, and even the kids at the end of elementary school, because if you stand them in front of a twin bucket toilet, they will immediately explain to you how it works. It's clear to them, and they want to talk about it. We advise if you meet a public official and they don't want to talk about it, sidestep it. Find the staffer who will. So it is hard. I'm glad you brought it up.
So I'd like to go over the basics of composting, but specifically in composting toilets and how they're waterless. The twin bucket system is something you brought up a few times in this conversation. And so just to give our listeners an idea of what the twin bucket system is you have a bucket, and you start each bucket with a material, a carbon source, as I know it. Sawdust is used as a carbon source. And there's usually a layer of sawdust, which you can find all over the place. You can also use horse pellets. You can use any other like hamster bedding if you live in the city. I know a lot of, not everybody has access to a place with sawdust, a lumber yard, or any woodworking shop.
The carbon source, yeah. Dry leaves, dry straw. Not green, because the green is nitrogen and we want the carbon. Yeah. Coffee husks.
Yeah.
A few other things.
So the carbon source being, you know, the sawdust, we need to offset the high amounts of nitrogen, which you just brought up, are in poop and also in urine.
Especially in urine. Nitrogen is especially in
very
urine.
Concentrated in urine. And so usually there's a ratio that, you know, you can do in your head. No one's measuring to perfect accuracy, you know,
25 to 1,
like 30 to 1, I think
good.
Is what we've used, and you can just do that by eye. Each time you go to the bathroom, you know, and you have a sealed toilet, you know, it's in a bucket, so it's not leaching or anything.
Well, it should breathe, so yeah. You can throw a net over it.
It's aerated, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay,
it
so you can have some type of, but at least around the seat, so
it flies out of it.
Yeah,
and
flies
but also your carbon material, your sawdust that you sprinkle on, is also going to help with that.
Yeah,
you're gonna cover it.
So each time you cover it, when you get to a certain height, you know, you don't want to go all the way over the lid, obviously. It sounds gross, but that's obvious. So you pull it out and you have a nice little area somewhere in your yard or, you know, depending where you are, but whatever makes the most sense for your area. You want to stay away from critical areas. You want to have a nice contained area where you can put a,
well,
you can dump
I'm
a bucket.
I'd like to even take that a little farther. The two operational things that we look at are container-based sanitation. So even your treatment facility is going to be contained. It might be contained on a slab, our composting facility here, which is co-composting of food waste, yard waste, and the biosolids from the wastewater treatment plant. Mm-hmm. So that is contained in a very well-managed system that we have here. So we talk about container-based sanitation, and we advise people to get lots of containers of all times, of all kinds, because they'll help us through the disaster. And then the other thing is urine diversion, separating the urine from the feces. The twin bucket toilet was endorsed within 2 months of our finding it by the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. And we started to take it across the city, and it's now in high-rise buildings. The building managers are actually stocking the buckets for the residents. But we also had an opportunity to do some prototyping ourselves through the Pacific Northwest College of Art, because Molly Danielson-Winter and Matthew Lippicott, who were working with us, they designed a course for graduate students in design. And we prototyped that at the 2011 Permaculture Convergence in St. Helens, Oregon. And so it was followed by off-site thermophilic composting and reuse in agriculture. Now, one lasting result of that work that was done by the students and their teachers at the college was the Sewer Catastrophe Companion, which talks about treatment and reuse following the disaster. And it's downloadable free from flush.org, which is our website, or the City of Portland website. So just Google Sewer Catastrophe Companion. I think that's the work I'd like to recommend to people because it addresses it. Now, given the difficulty of getting waivers from public health authorities, we look to a group called RECODE. They're based in Portland. They're under the Oregon Environmental Council, but they work with the Bullitt Foundation and others, and they're looking at legalizing sustainability. That's their mission, to legalize sustainability in California, Oregon, and Washington. And right now, what they're looking at is water and sanitation. We don't do much in code. We don't ask for waivers to prototype, but we work with these people who are actively working, including working in Olympia with our Washington State Legislature.
And Jefferson County just recently amended their code for waterless sewage treatment. That's just something to look into as well. If you're in this area, is to look up the waterless toilet code. And I won't give you the exact name of it, but you can find it pretty easily. I had no problem.
Yes, it comes right up.
Yeah.
If you just put waterless toilet code for.
So the twin bucket system is definitely the standard that most people use. You can YouTube any, composting toilets, and they usually have a bucket system. It's one I've seen everybody doing in my life.
Interesting. Now, we also have UDDTs, which are the same thing, which are urine diverting dry toilets. So the toilet in our boat, for example, has a little funnel, which funnels off the urine.
Yeah, I'm speaking not about the Sun Mars and the, you know, all the other proprietary composting toilet systems. I'm talking about the non-proprietary site-built, you know, do-it-yourself toilets, which is a bucket with a container over, you know, around it with a little area to grab sawdust or anything you're using. So that seems to be the standard. It's very easy to do. There's a little bit of maintenance involved. Weekly, you have to change it out. And that seems to be the standard that I've seen. And it can get a little messy. So honestly, where I've looked and the research I've done, I like the 55-gallon drum option where...
Yes.
It's like we said, containing this is very important because of leachate, vertical or horizontal separation.
Groundwater protection, too.
Yeah, you want to contain... So, you know, this is a much, and another thing that I wanted to bring up too is there are still people using pit latrines and they are big advocates of it. You know, it's the old school way of doing it, but it's not the best way. It really isn't. If you want ease and accessibility and you want this old lifestyle, it really is not that much of a stretch to just composting your
poop. Well, I'd say it's not acceptable. We have sea level rise. I mean, there's some places, Stewart Island, some places in the San Juans have been grandfathered in, but pit latrines are pretty unacceptable.
They're unacceptable. And they actually are not included in this amendment that Jefferson County just passed. One thing also to consider is, a high water table. You don't have to be next to a creek to be impacting groundwater and water quality in general. So this system as a alternative to the normal system and conventional means of exposing waste and compost as whatever you want to consider it, it's a lot easier. There's less maintenance involved. And so you just have a bigger container and you don't have to change it out as much as long as it's being aerated as much. But it's basically a site rather than off-site way of treating it.
Yeah. And when you're talking about these containers, I don't know if you know, but under the USDA rules, you can't resell a 55-gallon drum or any other container that's been used for food. You can't resell it for food use. So we advise households and neighborhoods to collect those things. They make good rain barrels, and then you've got them. But find used buckets and nest them.
Yeah.
And just keep them on hand. Most of what we call composting toilets, or many of them, they don't compost contents in the toilet, particularly in these northern climes. It's fairly difficult to meet the high temperatures required for effective composting in a small container. It's more realistic to consider the composting toilet a container to collect, contain, and transport fecal matter. Contents move to a composting site and preferably one at a decentralized and neighborhood level. Because unlike large wastewater treatment systems, decentralized facilities really do enhance community resilience. After using the toilet, you add a source of carbon, and we've said sawdust, wood chips, shredded paper, dry leaves, straw. If you've diverted the urine and keep the container aerated, there shouldn't be any unpleasant odor.
Mm-hmm.
There's no ammonia being released to create that odor, or there's much less. And the contents will reduce in volume. They'll desiccate.
And
they'll be easily manageable. People need to understand that they're easily manageable. Carbon-nitrogen ratios of 25 to 1. You say 30 to 1, that this is ideal. Now, treatment options for poop. Well, they range from simple pathogen reduction to full resource recovery. And so we can see them on a continuum. But there are risks that I think in the future we'll be looking at the risks of each of these systems rather than having a prescriptive code. So let's start out with the simplest thing, and that would be containment and retention. According to the National Research Council, retaining poop for 2 years makes it safe to use on food crops. I don't have authorization to do that, but that's what it is if we have to plan for a disaster. So the containers come in very handy. But now let's move on to composting. We hear talk of mesophilic composting and thermophilic composting, and I always forget that the mesophilic composting refers to the type of organism that does the work, the mesophiles. And they are these critters who are effective composters at between 68 and 113 degrees Fahrenheit. There's all different levels of composting, heat levels, and the different organisms that perform well, but that's that's shorthand. And then thermophilic composting is done by thermophiles, and they're the ones that love hot temperatures. 114 to 160 degree Fahrenheit is what they like. And these composting processes are sort of sequential, aren't they? They go, you know, the one set of bugs works and then another as the pile, the composting pile, heats up. But the amount of time you need to reach a certain temperature to have the treatment be effective is based on a whole bunch of other things: climate, season, the amount of rainfall, the type of ecosystem, and the troublesome pathogens you need to kill off. Ascaris is one of these. That's the eggs of parasitic roundworms, helminths. And they're pretty stubborn. Here's where we get the idea of letting them cook at about 140 degrees, 135 degrees for 3 days. I think 140 degrees is what the World Health Organization says.
I think the most common pathogens people are looking for are Salmonella and fecal coliform. That's usually what is the most
fecal coliform. Yeah, and those disappear pretty well.
Yeah.
with those guidelines.
When people are looking at waste, as they can consider it, they're looking for heavy metals. They're looking for pathogens, which we've spoken about a little bit, and then they're looking for plastics. They're looking for
pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, they're looking for a bunch of things. And personally, I feel that site systems are a little bit less likely to have all of the above than a huge contained area of everyone's, you know, combined waste. And it's also a better way to find the source of a pathogen where you know where it's coming from.
Yes. So if you have to track that, you have the epidemiology side of it. Yeah.
And so that meets the definition of a biosolid. And human waste compost as a biosolid, I think, is an important way of moving forward. There's a lot of different opinions on that. But that's the research that I've done. I've seen that that could be the best route to go. It just, the testing is involved. And actually, that's why I get excited, is because it's science-based. Is this safe? It's no longer going to be just a, everyone's doing it. Everyone's, you know, doing compost and no one's getting hurt. But I want to actually know. And so I think a science-based route would be a very important one to take, and to actually look, just like we do for biosolids today, that we do on a mass level, but to do it on a smaller scale. And it's just a lot more testing involved, but I think we can do it.
And it's a matter of getting those prototypes tested, getting the experimental procedures down, and moving ahead. And we don't have that yet, unfortunately. Yeah. We're moving very slowly toward that in the code and regulatory environment.
Yeah, and hopefully we can beat that natural disaster. But have any closing thoughts on this conversation?
Treatment of urine and pharmaceuticals, I would refer everybody to the work of the Rich Earth Institute in Vermont. They're showing treatment on land of urine does deal effectively with many of the pharmaceuticals.
Good to know. I'll check that out myself. So let's go back to that mystery sound and reveal it. That was a song of the brown-headed cowbird. The brown-headed cowbird is a stocky blackbird with a fascinating approach to raising its young. Females forego building nests and instead put all of their energy into producing eggs, sometimes more than 36 a summer. Cowbird fletchlings lay in the nests of other birds, abandoning their young to foster parents, usually at the expense of at least some of the host's own chicks. Once confined to the open grasslands of middle North America, cowbirds have surged in numbers and range as humans built towns and cleared woods. Thanks to the Cornell Ornithology Lab's Macaulay Library for these sound recordings and descriptions. For upcoming events, join Finn River and the North Olympic Salmon Coalition in celebration of the new year. On Monday, December 31st at Finn River Cider and Orchard, there will be a live jazz music, pebble blessings, a Chimicum Creek walk, and a special lighting of Finn, the giant migrating salmon. He's a great mascot for the area. Chimicum Creek walk will be led by the NOSC's stewardship coordinator, Sarah Doyle, who will elaborate on the importance of restoration in our community. There will also be a salmon-inspired craft station for kids. For the event schedule, go to Finn River Farm and Cidery's calendar. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community we live in. Thank you so much, Carol, for coming on our show and your dedication to the environment.
It's a real pleasure to be here, Paul, and thanks so much to you and your team at Nature Now for inviting me.
Happy holidays and winter solstice. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have any comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at 12:05 p.m. on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ at 91.9 FM on Thursdays at 5:05 p.m. and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Recent podcasts are also available on KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.